First Department Chairperson Francis G. Barrett. The contest promotes and celebrates the creative writing of students at Henry Ford College. We do have five winners, top five winners, and an honorable mention as well. The event is hosted by the English Department's Barrett Committee, and winners receive the Francis G. Barrett Memorial Scholarship. The Barrett Creative Writing Contest is open to works of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, experimental prose, and drama from those currently enrolled at Henry Ford College. Now, we're going to introduce the award winners in just a moment, but and then we're going to listen to what they have to say and some of their award-winning works. The ceremony took place last week, Thursday, April 21st, here on the campus of HFC. We do want to congratulate our honorable mention winner, Darcy Pastor, our fifth place winner, Georgia Beattie, fourth place winner, Kalima Gardner, third place winner, Elena Will, second place winner, Ashley Trent, and first place winner, Joaquin Bear. You'll hear more about those students and hear their works and the prizes that they have won as we listen to the event as it took place last Thursday here on the HFC campus. The Barrett Creative Writing Contest winners from Henry Ford College here on today's WHFR Journal.
Today, the Barrett Awards are on campus again for the first time since 2019. Thank you. It's good to see you in person as we slowly shake off the pandemic's disorienting effects. The last couple of years have had a strange jumbled timelessness that is hard to describe. In a word, Blur's Day. It is traditional to open Barrett with a poem, but this year I bring you a piece of experimental prose that I think resonates with our disjointed pandemic experience. The New York Times recently serialized Sheila Hetty's diary, each line of which she entered into a spreadsheet in order to rearrange the sentences in alphabetical order. The result is still her voice, her observations and experiences, her ongoing concerns, but the unsettling effect is like a puzzle whose pieces belong together but don't fit together. Here are the opening lines, alphabetically again. Actually, he doesn't love you. Actually, he doesn't want you. Actually, he's looking around the world for another girl. Because of who he is, he will find one and he will be with her. Added about 4,000 words, bringing it to 56,000. After all, one does have to get back to work. After he left, I lay in bed, hungover, and the sun was shining into my room for the day. After that, I got in a cab and came home. After that, we all walked by the river. Alice Munro's first book appeared when she was 37. All I am ambitious for is to publish this piece. All I ever wanted was to be an adult. All I ever wanted when I was younger was to be a writer, to be able to sit in one place and write things forever and not feel like I had anything to do, anything else to do. All I want are some more experiences with him. All I want is breakfast with my friends and to return home to the rest of this bright and beautiful sunny day. All I want is to read books for a year. All my work is so pleasurable these days. All of a sudden, he didn't seem very smart to me, and his belligerence wasn't very interesting. All of a sudden, I feel happy. All of my 20s were so strange. All of life is so strange. Welcome to the 47th Annual Francis G. Barrett Creative Writing Awards. My name is John Reitz, and I'm one of the seven members of the panel that selected this year's winning manuscripts. The committee includes Angela Hafakanavala, Peter Kim, Jessica Schamberger, Ruth Ann Schmidt, Maggie Rakowski, and new to the committee and to the college, Summer Starrod. Sorry to call you out on that. So welcome. The committee would like to thank all of those who submitted their poems and stories this year. It's an honor to have so many writers offer us their best work. And if the winners could please come up to the front, I'll introduce you and give you your awards. In the old days, a few years ago, we used to have people come up on stage and only then we would reveal what their place was. And we decided a few years ago that seems kind of mean. So they already know what they've won. But Darcy Pastor is here. Is not here yet. Okay. He's our honorable mention. Ren Beatty, first place winner. Helena Gardner, first place winner. Elena Will, third place winner. Ashley Trent, second place winner. And Joaquin Bear, our first place winner. Each year, the Bear Committee also selects someone for the Larry Coulter Poetry Prize Award. And that honor this year goes to Elena Will. You might remember that Elena won the Coulter Prize last year, too, when she took first prize in the Bear Contest. Elena. Well, congratulations to you all. And if you will all sit down, we'll begin with, we don't have Darcy here. So we'll begin with our fifth place winner, who is, you know who you are, right? Georgia Baby Red. Okay, so the others maybe come down from the stage and Georgia will read from her work here.
Hi. The microphone seemed lower back when I was sitting. I was like, yay, it's my height. Okay, I don't want to mess it up. All right. Hello, everybody. My name is Jessica Schamberger. I work in the ELI here. I am here to introduce Ren. Ren submitted the pieces entitled Don't Look, Time, and Worms. From the first sentence of each one of those readings, I was immediately hooked and taken back to an early part of my childhood for family movie night. So my brother and I would like curl up next to my mom on the couch, and we'd settle down for a nice, wholesome movie night of horror. That was what we do. And like weird horror, like Pumpkinhead 2 and like Leprechaun from the Hood and like Children Underneath the Stairs and Fright Night and Critters, like those, like The Howling 1 through 5, like that was like our wholesome movie event. Yeah, I know, right? So when I was reading Ren's work, those memories kind of flooded back to me. And I knew before speaking with them that we had a kindred spirit. And it was like we both were massive fans of horror, which it was confirmed when I talked to Ren. So it's really, yeah, it was really great. So Ren is going to read from A Piece Called Time. And the words tell a story, and that story really sprang from the page, and I became a part of it. So it became less of a passive experience. I felt like I had like VR goggles on, and I was actually in that room with the white walls and just in that whole immersive experience because of all the imagery and the way that the story was told. And I don't know what that says about my personality, that I'm really drawn to that kind of thing, but I'm not alone and I'm in good company, so I feel okay. Even though we are here to celebrate Ren's amazing storytelling ability, they are also quite talented in other ways. And this is crazy. So Ren taught herself how to sew, and they do costume design, like historical women's costume design from like the 1700s. Like, yeah, I've been sewing for 4 years and I designed a whole entire dress. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is insane. They also act for 7 years on stage. And also do makeup design. Like, they taught themselves how to do makeup. Like, I just watched a YouTube video. I'm like, ah! You can't be good at so many things. Also, when I was speaking with Ren as well, I'm not going to give their age away in case it's a secret. The maturity that they had is just mind-blowing. At that age, I had no real direction. I didn't know what my real passions were. And I told Ren as well that it's really great that their passions are also things that they're good at. because that doesn't always happen. So I went to school for my undergrad to be a screenwriter. Could I write screenplays? Nope. But I'm just like, but I like it. I'm like, well, you have to have some talent. Right. So it's really great to see that they have such clear set goals. And Ren will hopefully be working in the cinematic world of costume design. So I hope one day we can watch them accept their Oscar for best costume design in a movie. So that'd be great. All right. So without further ado, please welcome Ren for the reading of Time.
Time stretched to an eternity. A minute felt like an hour and vice versa. God knew how long I had been sitting there, staring, or maybe he didn't. There are things that even gods can't tell. My eyes must have been open for days, weeks, staring, but no, that can't be right. It's only been a few seconds. Time is fickle. It can stretch further than we can comprehend or become smaller than we know. To say that you can tell time is a white lie, made only for comfort. My eyes burned, dry and unseeing, but blinking seemed exhausting. Everything seemed exhausting these days. I could hear voices, incomprehensible sounds of people I might have known before, now little more than white noise in my head. I felt like I should know them, should recognize the inflections and pitches. I strained to hear them, but the sound was covered up by the ugly beige of the wall in front of me. The color was deafening. It was ugly. So ugly it was a wonder it had been chosen from the store. Anyone choosing it must have been half mad. Wait, wasn't I in my room? The room I had painted with the color I carefully chose? That couldn't be right. I couldn't have been in my right mind to choose this ugly beige paint. I was somewhere new. It had been eons since I was somewhere new. I had been here forever. Time is fickle. My eyes were unfocused, seeing only the dirty white wall. There were sounds. Voices? I couldn't be sure. I heard a name a couple of times. Not my name. Surely not my name. Because who would be talking about me somewhere with dirty white walls where time is fickle? People came and went. Dirty white clothes, eyes without a face, plastic-coated hands. They changed my clothes, but I couldn't move. Who cares? They're just people. People matching the walls, people matching the bedding, people matching each other. Everything is the same here. Time isn't real. It's the same, in and out. Everything changes to different but identical versions. Billions of times I've changed but stayed the same. I've lived today a billion times and never gone to sleep. Time is fickle. This time was different. When the faceless people came in, they changed my clothes, my bedding, checked my unseeing eyes and unhearing ears. Something was announced to the room. They seemed sad, particularly the group in the corner, the only ones not dressed in white. I was laid down and rolled out of the dirty white room, down a dirty white hall, eyes blinded by the fluorescent tube lights. I was rolled into a metal room and laid on a metal bed. My eyes looked without seeing. My ears listened without hearing. I was prodded and poked, then rolled into a different room. Small, dark, hot. I wanted to scream, my mouth forced shut. I wanted to blink, my eyes stuck open. Then the fire started. White hot, painful. Heat rushed through my body, feeling but unresponsive. Time was real here, real and eternal. I was engulfed in flames for eons. I don't know when it ended or even if it did. All I know is that I'm in a new place. It has been eons since I was somewhere new. I've been here forever. Time is fickle. Thank you.
Kalima Gardner has been writing poetry since childhood. And although she has never had any formal training until Ruth Ann Schmidt's class last semester, her poems have won Kroger's I Can Make History contest twice, in 2013 and 2015. Looking back on what she has written over the years, Kalima notices that her poems typically focus on people's internal experiences, particularly, as she says, trauma and triumph. Her Barrett-winning poem, Doll's Eyes, addresses both. When prompted by an assignment to write about childhood, Kalima recalled a time when she found herself gazing into the distorting funhouse mirror of American racial identity. Although her parents were careful to give her dolls that reflected her own skin tone, Kalima asked for and received the popular Maxie doll. If you haven't seen her, Maxie is white. They actually have a photo of her here. Maxie is white and looks very much like a Barbie doll, with Barbie's famously implausible physique. But Maxie also has blue eyes and an absurd, impossible to ignore explosion of blonde hair. To underscore the obvious, Hasbro's commercials featured the slogan, "Who's that girl with the beautiful hair?" Kalima's poem echoes that slogan, asking how one could be so beautiful. Having absorbed her culture's codes of race and beauty, the young girl's dreamy admiration for the doll is accompanied by a painful realization that her own appearance doesn't conform to this ideal. Like Pecola Breedlove, got a lot of visual props today, like Pecola Breedlove in The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison's first novel, the poem's speaker feels the world's judgment in the gaze of the, quote, doll's eyes. But unlike Pecola, Kalima's speaker has the internal resources to triumph over this, quote, artificial monster. And in the end, her healthier perceptions are restored so that her, quote, brown eyes will never see the doll again. Not after she reorients herself to, quote, the sweet taste of brown.
Good afternoon, everyone. My brown eyes glow in wonder at this porcelain beauty. I run stubby fingers across her tiny frame, admiring the porcelain beauty before my big eyes. And I smile ear to ear, her swirling curls dancing like stars on a quiet night, landing softly. Each strand wonderfully made her more beautiful. Frazzled, dark coils never seem to take light. Foolishly, they're no stranger to me. No freckled on her powdered face, no frivolous lines stealing her unconquered grace. Just plain white fields swaying in the sun. But dark shadows lay burning hands on my wishful spirit. Judgment poking my sides, peering deeper into my hollow shell. How one could be so beautiful? I let words fly off my tongue, stinging of jealousy, envy lingers. I try to color you me, slabbing pigment on canvas. I paint you brown till our eyes intertwine. And I sit in disappointment, peering at a stranger who mocks my skin. And I throw away a damaged beauty, no longer enticed. Disgust taints my tongue, tasting of putrid meat, laying under a boiling sun. You know, I wish for so long to be you that I swallowed myself, forgetting what I taste like. Now, the sweet taste of brown coats my throat. How foolish I was comparing to a mere plastic artificial monster who almost scared away my brown eyes. My brown eyes will never see her again.
Hi, I'm Summer Starrud. I am the newbie. When I heard that I would be interviewing this next writer to introduce her, I wanted to play it cool. I loved her poems, and she's in multiple rock bands, and I didn't want to come off lame. So I thought it would be fun to include a sort of James Lipton question behind the Actor Studio. If any of you know it, she wasn't aware, so she had no idea what I was talking about when I told her. But I asked her as a final question what her favorite word was, and she busted out laughing, and she said, lasagna. And I was like, oh, is that like your favorite food too? And she's like, actually, no, I don't really like lasagna very much. But it's a great word, right? It's got that Anya at the end. And I thought that was so great. Like, leave it to a poet to love Anya, right? She appreciated the word lasagna more than the thing itself, which I thought was wonderfully paradoxical and interesting, just like her poems. For example, in one poem, she compares the speaker's falling in love to a narcoleptic falling down a flight of stairs. And in another poem, Elena uses natural images to describe a very unnatural experience, portraying the victim of a violent crime as a butterfly and the perpetrator as an entomologist. She gives readers the pleasure of verse that has been derived from the pain of experience, using poetry to make sense out of the senseless. What makes total sense, however, is that Elena is a poet. She's been a lyricist for some time. Did I mention she's in a band, multiple bands? And she plays several instruments, and she teaches those instruments to people. Her primary instrument here at Henry Ford as a classical voice major is, well, her voice. This also makes sense, as her voice seems to be her primary instrument in her poems too. Full of nuance, emotion, and bittersweet playfulness, her lines, though often short, at least the ones I've had the pleasure of reading, are full of punchy paradoxes about the struggles of being human. My mind must have one state, my body opposing. The two have no fate of their forms interposing. I'm grateful to have met Elena and to have read her poems. I'm pleased to introduce her as not only our third place Barrett Prize winner, but also our first place Coulter Poetry Prize winner. Please welcome Elena Will.
Hello, I'm going to read a few poems for you today. I'm going to start off a little bit less personal. As some of you may know me from last year, this year I got a little bit darker and more personal. I did not expect a place, so I'm a little bit nervous to read today. So like I said, I'm going to ease you into it. So today I'm going to start off with poems about love and the lack thereof. Babe, I'm falling for you like a narcoleptic down a flight of stairs. Like a dog seizing from too many stab wounds, I froth at the mouth and quake only for your loving sake. Shoot me up one last time. Tap the twisted vein that starts at my heart and drowns my bleeding brain. Enough of those stupid romance words you stole from a dime store shelf. Love me in some and save up your 10-cent plagiarisms for my downpour. I dig out the marrow, dip my brush in Bob Ross your portrait with my ache, and oh, for God's sake, don't break your own bones to fix mine. Thank you. A lot of my poems are short, so I'm going to read a couple if that's okay. This next poem is called My Body Contorts. I feel like this one needs a little bit more explanation. I live with bipolar disorder, so I experience life a little bit differently than people without bipolar disorder. One of those things, I have always experienced kind of a disconnect between mind and body. I always joke that my mind and my body are at odds. Like, when something's going wrong with my mind, my body is perfectly fine. And when something's, like, everything's good, like, mental health-wise, like, I'm great, you know? Something's got to be going wrong with my body. Like, it's always, like, either mental health issues or physical health issues. So that's kind of what this poem is about. It's called My Body Contorts. My body contorts. I think athwart. My body stands tall. I think till I gall. My mind must have one state, my body opposing. The two have no fate of their forms interposing. Suppose they decided to meet at the heart, only to be divided, it would rip me apart. So be blessing or curse, each one must be cast, lest I be immersed, mind and body must contrast. Now here's where it gets personal. So I was really nervous to submit this poem for anything ever. This is the first and only poem I have ever written about being raped. It's called The Entomologist. One. He pinned me down like a butterfly in a cork board and ripped off my wings. 2. An entomologist's kiss sent me into a raging flutter. Torn from my flower, I threw myself against the mirror as if it was a pane of glass, an openable window. 3. That summer flew by without me, flightless. I withered under thick heat. You found me on the asphalt, dying, still dancing in his web. Thank you. This is my last poem. It is my longest poem. It is also a dramatic poem. You won't know that till the end, though, so I guess I shouldn't have spoiled it. This one is called Our Love in the Key of G Minor. I'm not sure if this was something that went over anybody's heads, but as a music major, I've used a lot of music terminology as far as every chord in a key in a song has specific terms used for it, whether it's minor, major, diminished, augmented, whether it's the tonic, the subtonic, the submediant. I wanted to incorporate a lot of musical terminology into this poem because the person that this poem about was also a musician. I knew if they ever read it that they would get it and they would be more hurt if they read it. Right? Sometimes the intention is not so great when you're writing a poem. And their name also started with G, so G minor. G minor. Yes, we were harmonic, passing a fifth between us. Only intoxicated were we ever in unison. I hit the F sharp. The tension tastes like oranges. I see two American spirits laid out on the coffee table, and the hair on the back of my neck is raised. I skip to A. The first day, I mean, was short of minor. Let my sad eye drift back to recall how the seconds diminished. B flat, I begged of myself, as if the flattening of my roots would further augment the arguments. I believed that the third time was the charm that you could change like I had for you. On to D. D for dominance. You needed total control, suggesting you were major to any potential I had. Wrote a contract, but I knew it was a deal with the devil. E flat reminds me of times of triumph because despite the depths, the darkness, there was endless desire to prove that we could be happy. I tried to meet you in the middle, but always ended up submediant. Let's end on C. C, I was a minor, not even 16, before you, Sir 22, set your sights on me. So ensnared in a sick tangle for two, submissive and sweet. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Maggie Rutkowski, and I am especially excited to have the honor of introducing our honorable mention winner this year, Darcy Pastor. Darcy is the author of a collection of haiku poems, and as a Spanish instructor here at HFC, I'm thrilled to set the stage for you for this brilliant bilingual work. During our conversation earlier this week, Darcy told me, "This is my story." Darcy takes us on a journey with these 14 haikus, starting with Nepantalism, from an Aztec word meaning torn between two ways, and ending with Take Your Bullshit and Go, my personal favorite, in which our author proudly declares, I'm going to be me. In this collection, Darcy bares her soul to the reader, sharing her own experiences as a young woman of three cultures who has lived in three countries. In Guatemala, she is too Mexican and too American. In Mexico, too white, and in the U.S., too Latin. Where do I belong, she asked herself and us as readers. I am all of them and none of them at the same time. These powerful haikus evoke that struggle, that choque or crash of identities. Through them, we feel the sexism, machoism, and inequality that Darcy has. Why do you think you have the right to oppress me, to do that to anyone? This collection is her expression of navigating womanhood in three countries, describing Quetzalcoatl as touching her roots, Charito as a big F you, and Madonna as the unemotional question of, do you understand the meaning of what you call? Darcy is a self-proclaimed lover of words and a philosophy major, and there is no better poetry genre in which to start by picking the words you want to include, as she explained her process. Among her inspirations, she counts Shakespeare, a school project in Mexico of creating an Aztec-style poem, and the haiku challenges she would create with her great at math sister to show her own superiority. She grew up listening to the rhymes and wordplay of Dr. Seuss and Amelia Bedelia, understanding that every word has its place and its power. She credits Gloria Anzaldúa's La Conciencia de la Mestiza as opening her eyes to her own identity in cultural crisis. This collection of Darcy's work served as her final project in Dr. Mike Hill's philosophy class last fall, and we owe Dr. Hill a great debt of gratitude for recommending that Darcy enter our own Bear Creative Writing Contest. I was flabbergasted to learn that Darcy created this work, start to finish, in order, in one sitting, without changing a single word. Wouldn't we all love to get so much right the first time? This also bodes well for her as a baker, too, with her specialty of pumpkin pie. Without further ado, I present to you the brilliant bilingual author, Darcy Pastor herself, to read her winning collection of haikus in its entirety.
I'm a little late, so I'm sorry. But I'll start. Nepati dice, divided into choker and conciencia in their self-doubts. Choker, what should I choose? No, what should I choose now? Cultural identities, choose so you can bow. Transcendent, this duality, accept the power of it, the reality. Obacalle, San Mestiza ya, do what you'd like, it's your choice, son of tu cuerpo. Homology, no place to call home, we are not, doesn't matter, invalid always. Womanhood, it's easy, right? Just to get told what to do, welcome womanhood. Quetzalcoatl, transform from the dirt, como tu dios azteca, this suelo fly high. Christ, in between my legs, does this define who I am? Is this what I'm worth? Concepción mía, I'm more, yo soy yo, mi conciencia es esta, I myself, mi I. Hypocrisy, so powerful yet it's your own self-doubt, perhaps. Why are you scared, amor? Charito, what did I say wrong? I said the truth, macho, llora con mamá. Madonna, you f*** around too, llámame puta cabrón, what's the difference? General norms. Are you happy now? Do you like to watch my pain? Oppression feels good. Take your bullshit and go. Not anymore, I won't. I always like cherries more. Take your bullshit and go. Thank you.
You're listening to the WHFR Journal here on WHFR Making Waves. Today on our program, we're presenting the Barrett Creative Writing Contest Award Winners Ceremony, which took place last Thursday here on the HFC campus. The Francis G. Barrett Memorial Creative Writing Contest is held annually by the college and honors the memory of the English department's first department chairperson and celebrates the creative writing of students at Henry Ford College. We continue listening to these award-winning works from these wonderful and very, very talented authors here on today's WHFR Journal.
Hi, I'm Ruth Ann Schmidt. I teach a number of English classes here at HFCC, along with creative writing. And I'm so honored to get to introduce Ashley Trent. There are lots of things I could tell you about her, but I'm going to keep this particular introduction rather brief so she can read her full piece. Here goes. Ashley's winning essay, Landmines, depicts the complicated dance between fathers and daughters. In her own words, she explores trauma and forgiveness without apology. Ashley's voice will enthrall us and then punch us in the gut and leave us doubled over, wheezing with astonishment. She'll capture us in spare domestic landscapes in the kitchen, a bedroom, a car, where a push, a slap will happen without reason. Her voice will put us between a father and a daughter, where a delicate balance of recriminations and tendernesses will occur. Love will flash on and off. A war is coming. Ashley's brutal and honest voice, made for the revelations and the hard truths of the personal essay, will tell us so. She writes, his outbursts were landmines. And some days I knew where they were and how to step around them. Most days I did not. And now I'm going to give you our second piece winner, Ashley.
Hi. Okay, so here's Landmine. The light in the kitchen doubled as the door eased forward and the scent of my father's cigarettes filled the room. He was home from work at the usual time. He carried a garment bag over his shoulder, smiling sheepishly at me, while clutching his cigarette between his lips. "Why are you just getting home now?" I asked, the confusion apparent in my voice. His mother had passed away that morning, and I received the call 7 hours earlier. I stood with the entire room between us, my feet rooted but prepared to retreat, not yet sure of the mood he might be in. I had to go buy a suit for the funeral. He was too calm, too cheery for this occasion. I had long since grown accustomed to trying to make my way out of the house by 4 o'clock each afternoon in anticipation of his typical state of anger. I had observed his explosive temper for 15 years, and although I had learned to take it in stride, it was still something I feared being faced with. Once, when I was 9 years old, I spilled a glass of water into the carpet in his bedroom. He exploded with fury, his hand connecting to the side of my small head with the full force of his stocky 6-foot frame. Bright white flashes burst across my vision as my head rocked to the side. My hair flew in different directions and tears ejected involuntarily from my eyes. Many days brought him home from work, angry and looking for a fight. He might bellow over a single glass or dish sitting in the sink, with words such as lazy and stupid flying toward my ears with force comparable to that of his hand. Other offenses worthy of this treatment included, but was far from limited to, not moving furniture to the basement by myself, including a couch, not that I've been asked beforehand, not understanding my math homework, receiving a grade less than a B on my report card, not knowing the answer to a question he asked, not sorting and preparing the bills properly, or not washing dishes precisely the way he did. Many times, if something was going wrong for him, such as an endless line of cars when we were already late to a family gathering, I caught the back of his hand just the same as if the traffic had been in my control. When Child Protective Services were called, I faced his wrath and spent a weekend anxiously cleaning the house to a pristine state before their home visit. On days when I was angry enough to fight back, demanding to know why he would say such cruel things to me, it only got worse. His fury would skyrocket. His screams bellowed past his lips like a crazed grizzly bear. A foamy spit would fly from his lips as he flung words which bit and tore at my heart. "You're a f***ing bitch, you know that? No one is ever going to love you. Stop crying. You have no idea what pain is. You have no reason to cry. You know I have high blood pressure. Do you want to make me have a heart attack and die?" His fists would pummel the wall, the cabinets, my head, always the head, until I would break down and lock myself in the bathroom, my only safe refuge, hyperventilating through my sobs until he retreated into his bedroom. Sometimes, my father was my best friend and everything I hoped to become. We would talk about philosophy, music, politics, and the state of humanity. We would make jokes, engage in sarcastic and witty banter, and laugh to the point of tears about puns. In times like this, he was my favorite person in the entire world. I knew this to be the person my father truly was. This was the person I had known as a very young child. This was the person I missed daily and would do anything for. His outbursts were landmines, and some days I knew where they were and how to step around them. Most days I did not. I began to look for signs. This might be a screaming and hitting day. Eventually, I could tell by the feeling hanging in the air when he came home. If it were light, I would probably be okay. If it hung heavy and burdensome, I was most likely in for it and needed to hide to keep myself safe. The afternoon his mother died, he stood utterly calm. I asked him questions about how he was feeling. "Are you okay? Do you need to talk? Can I do anything for you?" He cocked his head, smiled warmly at me, and said, "You've already been through this. You lost your mom years ago. You are so strong." I knew he meant it. He wasn't angry. This was in stark contrast to what I was used to. At 8 years old, I lost my mother to suicide. Though I tried desperately to talk about it with him in the beginning, he would become sullen and bitter, telling me to stop feeling sorry for myself and to suck it up. I ultimately dealt with the loss by sitting alone on my bed each night, wailing and screaming at God for taking her from me, at her for leaving. Eventually, my sob-worn body would crumble into a pile on the pink carpet as my father snored loudly in the next room. Now my father was suddenly interested in how I had felt about it for the first time in 15 years. As we spoke, he lowered himself into one of the chairs, resting an arm on the weathered wood of the kitchen table. The conversation was light and polite. His interest was genuine. When the tears started, they were his. I threw my arms around his broad shoulders as comfortingly as I could. Sobs racked his body as he removed his glasses to wipe the tears away. "I'm so sorry, Ashley. I tried." "I know, Dad. It's okay." He began telling me the details of the night my mother died that he had never shared with anyone before. I implored him to seek professional help, but he said it was too late. In his mind, there was no point. I could only hold him until his tears stopped. A month later, I found him in his bed. He was cold, stiff, and silent. His heart had finally stopped breaking, but only because it ceased. He was finally at peace. After my father's death, I held so many feelings inside that I was numb for a long time. I was angry at what he allowed himself, myself, and our relationship to become. The years of abuse and neglect I'd had to endure, and his insistence that he was utterly alone and misunderstood in his pain. He had been blind to my presence at his side the entire time, waiting for him to see that we were a team. I had done all I could to help him see this, but he either didn't listen or couldn't hear me. It should have been he and I against the world, at least in my mind. Some people, including my therapist at the time, offered the theory that maybe my father's absence in my life might be for the better. I never kept the way my father treated me much of a secret, and even if I had, his landmines had gone off enough in front of my friends that it would have been useless to try. After he died, I spent countless nights stewing in my anger and hurt, or doubled over, tormented by the pain of imagining what my father must have gone through the night the love of his life and the mother of his child took her own life before his eyes, despite his efforts to save her. This empathy helped me to forgive my father, even though the apology could never come to fruition. I realized the truth was, my mother took more than just her life with that bullet. She took his as well. The man who was my father died that same night in 1995, but somehow his body kept going until 2010. That snarling grizzly was not my father, nor had he ever been. My heart will always ache for him, but I have set us both free from my resentment for how he responded to his own struggles through his realizations. At some point, the realization struck that I could carry my anger and resentment, my guilt for his unhappiness and death, my pain for what had transpired in both our lives, and it would wear on me forever. Or I could let it go, forgiving him, so I could finally be at peace as well. The landmines, after all, were perils for us both.
Hey, folks. My name is Angela, and today I have the pleasure of introducing Joaquin Bear, our first place author. Joaquin is in his first returning year as a liberal arts English major here at HFC, and the story he'll be sharing with you, titled Never Yours, was one he originally worked on last semester in creative writing, English 139, which you should, of course, all consider taking. This semester, he's a student in my 20th century American literature course, where he consistently makes valuable contributions to discussions with his classmates and writes wonderfully stream of consciousness journal entries about the works that we're reading. As a student, he's the master of the pause, taking in a question, thinking, considering, before responding thoroughly, thoughtfully, inviting those around him into conversation rather than a verbal sparring match. I gotta tell you the story. So last week, Joaquin was not able to be in our class, which normally happens right now. So the other people in my class are here. Hi. It's a small class. But I had to tell them, right, that like this week, don't come to class. Come to K14. Come to the Barrett Creative Writing Awards. And here's why. It's because Joaquin, who isn't here, is one of the winners. And they all spontaneously broke into applause, which was the cutest thing, even though he wasn't even there. Don't cry. It's okay. But really, delightful. Just delightful to have him in class. But about him, he loves to read all the things. And I imagine his part-time gig with the Dearborn Library System only reinforces that particular habit, at least when he isn't studying for, you know, exams and stuff. Reading the Bluest Eye, so thanks for referencing that. Mm-hmm. That was good. Good timing. His family has indigenous roots on both sides. Ojibwe of the Lac Coeur d'Alene band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians on one side, Putepecha Apache on the other. In the excerpt you'll hear today, take note of the artful way Joaquin weaves in elements of Ojibwe culture and the Anishinaabe Mohan language. You'll also hear about love, possibly, about heartache, definitely, and about breaking the cycle of a toxic relationship, maybe, or about listening to the wisdom of generations of experience, of the ancestors, maybe, or maybe about taking a good long look at those around you and accepting reality instead of the story we wish is true. Whatever you take away from Never Yours, I do know you'll enjoy it. Joaquin Miguet, thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, everyone, for coming today. I wanted to preface this by saying that I had originally subtitled the story Never Yours with "He is mental illness," but I decided to change it and I offer a alternate subtitle, which is "They Always Think They Own Him." I'm only reading an excerpt of this, so I'm going to briefly summarize the first half. The main character, Jimmy, runs into an ex-boyfriend of his. And yes, this is a queer story. He runs into an ex-boyfriend, they talk, and they decide to meet up the next day. So that's where I'm going to be picking up. I decided that I need to grill him. It's the following evening, and I'm sitting in my car. Outside the bar, we agreed to meet. I'm so keyed up. I slept like shit, and I haven't eaten much all day. The last 24 hours feel like a dream. After we parted ways, I went home and tried to relax. Food wasn't appetizing. I tried to sleep, but my mind kept racing with questions that doubted everything Anthony said. None of last night made any sense. I was just standing in the bookstore, and he just happens to show up. He said he was saying hi, but how is that just a coincidence if he's going to follow me out of the store and talk to me? He needs to have an end game. I step out of my car, close the door, and start heading in. I lock the door behind me as I take in the darkening sky. White gray clouds are rolling in. That means snow might be falling tonight. I chose this bar for two reasons. It's familiar to me, and I know the bar staff here, and they make amazing hamburgers. If I'm going to talk to this man tonight, I need a good meal and a drink. When I enter, I see he's sat down already, nursing a vape pen with two beers in front of him. I seal myself and I go and sit down. "Hey!" The forced cheer in my voice makes him jump a bit. He looks up from his phone and smiles. I can't tell if it's fake or real because he still doesn't meet my eyes. "You ordered for me already?" "Oh, I hope you don't mind." He pauses to take a puff from his pen. "You like cider, right? Still?" "Yeah, I'm suspicious." He never cared like this before. Ordering ahead for me, I take the glass in my hand and I inspect it. It's still frosty, but looks harmless. I sip it, savoring its bittersweet flavor. "Thanks." I exhale. "Look, Tony, I..." He begins to interrupt, but I put my hand up to stop him. Take a large gulp from my cider and continue. "Please, let me finish. I'm going to eat something, maybe order another cider. Great choice, by the way. In the meantime, we are not going to discuss a damn thing. I don't even want to discuss the weather right now. I'm hungry. I slept like crap, and I would like to eat first, please." He doesn't speak for a second, and he doesn't meet my gaze. After a pause, he simply nods. Great. After that, we can discuss whatever you want then, but we are going to talk about us. So with that, I summon the barmaid, and she takes our food order. Her name is Jenny, and she and I are friendly. I give her a glance and a wink when Anthony isn't looking to give her the signal that I'm okay, and she leaves. We pretend to watch the sports game on TV. I don't follow it. Our food order comes, and I am salivating. I take that first bite of food in nearly 24 hours, and my taste buds ignite my other senses. The smell of grilled beef, the feel of cooling grease on staining my hands, the taste of cheese and mushrooms. It all gets my blood circulating again in ways you only know from being hungry. I clear my plate, and I'm wiping my hands clean. I'm silent while the ciders are replaced, and I finally speak. "You know, I've lost count of how many times we fought that resulted in me leaving because of how low you take things." He looks up, having not expected that. "I know," he nods, swallowing his last punch fry. "I've done that, and that's what I want to make up for. You say you're doing better?" My voice is steady. Yeah, man, I told you. He says that with a quickness. He sounds like a patient. Why were you at the bookstore? I asked nonchalantly. I was looking for a book. There's an upward inflection at the end of the book. Then what did you get? I know I sound paranoid, but I try to force my voice to sound casual. Oh, you know, it was, he tells me the title. It's a book I know he already has. Oh, I exclaim, feigning interest. I know he's full of shit. Was that the new edition that just got printed? Yeah, man. He's smiling again, but something seems off. He's still not looking directly at me. Maybe it's the sight, but I'm feeling gutsy. And the next words out of my mouth are out before I can stop myself. There wasn't a new edition, Tony, and I gave you that book 10 years ago. Cut the shit. What were you doing in that bookstore? He freezes, cheeks turning an actual shade of red. That's new. I never caught him off guard like this. I was hoping you'd be there, James. He admits, looking down into his glass. Listen to me. I'm sorry for how I've treated you. I realize now I made a mistake. He trails off, and I wave my hands to get him to continue. I've heard this from him before, and I'm hoping there's more to it this time. Those times we were together, while we didn't have an official name for it, those were the nicest times of my life. I felt calm laying in your arms. You were so warm and caring and gentle. It was a mistake for me to push you away like I did. I shouldn't have chosen Alma to be with. I'm so unhappy, dude. I already told you this, I know, but he pauses to grab a sip of beer, and I can feel the anger rising in me. I've heard all of this before. I breathe, and I let him continue. I need you in my life, closest. He reaches for my hand, and my blood goes cold. Don't call me that, I say, staying perfectly still. I don't dare move a muscle, but I can feel my stomach doing a somersault at this sudden physical contact. I must tense up slightly because he recoils his hand as if he was burned. The heat rises in my chest. A coincidence. So that's why you came looking for me? I asked, not waiting for his response. We've been through this before, Anthony. You just can't come looking for me when you're bored with your girlfriend. You and I both know Alma's at home, ignorant of this, whatever this is. At Alma's mention, he starts sputtering, trying to put on a face of indignation. He spits his next words at me. Yeah, you know what? You're right. I thought this would be easy, but on the waterworks and Jimmy will put out. Usually, I just needed to call you by your super-secret Indian name, and you'd melt like butter. He gets up and he starts to leave. Well, whatever. Should have known he'd go for it on me. I stand up and I follow him. I catch up before he reaches the door. I tug his shoulder, spin him towards me, and I throw a punch, aiming right at his head. What'd I miss? His fist connects with my nose head-on. My head jerks back, but rather than falling back or the world going black, the world around me, it freezes. I don't mean the crowd of people stop to look, though there are some folks whose eyes we caught with this embarrassing tussle. I mean time is standing still. Suddenly I'm standing next to myself and I'm viewing the scene. I'm viewing the scene as if I'm another bystander. What the hell is this? I mutter. Ningozis, I hear a voice behind me. I can't place how I know it, but I know they called me my son. I turn to face them, and it's a man, about my age, dressed in familiar clothes that look comfortable. They belong to a different time. Something in his face is familiar. I ask, What is this? Who are you? I have much to tell you, son, but for now, I'm here to help you. His voice echoes in my head. He's not speaking English the way I know it, but I understand him. Okay, now I shall miss. He pauses and he nods. I pause and he nods in approval. I'm listening, Grandpa. It's the only respectful word I know to use when addressing an older person who is about to teach you something. He appears young, but he carries himself with an ageless grace I have only seen in my elders. This one, he points at Anthony, still frozen in time with an ugly expression of malice I've never witnessed in such detail. He likes you. He never loved you. He likes you. He liked you for what you could give him. I know you knew this, but you were wrong to blame yourself. You never looked him in the eye because he never allowed. He knows your power and it frightens him. He knows that without your unconditional love, he has no power over you. He wears you down until you accept it. I listen, trying to understand grandfather's meaning. You have always had power. Even now, in this moment, generations of compassion and intuition live on in you. You've always been able to see it into a person's eyes and know their truth. But your most valuable power has been the ability to walk away, to let go. Think of those settlers and their ancestors. Their most powerful civilizations have all crumbled to dust. People walk away, my son. I'm incorporeal, but I can feel a surge of emotion at the last point. Remember this. You may walk away. You may let go. But we will always walk with you. Ooh, I say. All of us. He nods behind him and I see faces that weren't there before. Familiar faces. I understand them. Just listen for the wind if you ever have doubt. Miigwech dimashamas. Thank you. In a heartbeat, the world spins. In a heartbeat, the world begins spinning again and I'm stumbling backwards as if I never left my body. Still reeling from a punch. It doesn't hurt as bad as I thought it would. I check for blood and look back up to see Anthony turning away to avoid my eyes again. He makes for the door. He does not make it. I'm on him before his hand even touches the push bar. I spin him again and I pull him in a hard grip so we're face to face. I know we're attracting attention. I know it looks like we're about to kiss, but I don't care. I force him to look me in the eyes and I finally see him for what he is. Our eyes lock for a split second, but that's all I need. I see him sitting alone as a boy in his bedroom. A man is standing over him. I feel his terror. His longing for his mom. I see him making his girlfriend mama cry while the baby screams in the background. I feel the swelling sense of pride as if it were an accomplishment. I see him looking at me when we first met, when we first kissed, when we took each other's virginity. The night we broke up, the night we made up, the cycle that repeated itself ad nauseum. I feel his confusion, his revulsion with himself, his fleeting pleasure at being with me, and the cathartic release of seeing me walk away from him. I see him seeing me talking to another young man, and I feel the jealous rage of an angry toddler. I see all of this in a flash, and it's gone. I let him free from my grip. He knows what I saw. He's looking at me with a look I've never seen on his face before. It is a mask of wide-eyed terror. I just stare him down. He stumbles away out the door into the night. I look around at everyone. I don't need to say the cliche phrase. Everyone simply goes back about their business. The music resumes. I pay my tab and leave a good tip. The barmaid, Jenny, gives me a hug and bids me good night. I always like to hear because of her. I step out and I notice how cold it is for the first time in 2 days. Snow is barely beginning to fall and the winds are picking up. I can almost swear they're howling. Despite this, I feel warm and comforted. I get into my car and I start the engine. I feel free for once. And I smile to myself as I drive home. Thank you.
Well, everything we heard was very good, but I'm always surprised every year at how much better the manuscripts sound when they're read aloud by the person who wrote them. It's really surprising. It's so surprising I have to say it every year. But that's it. That's the 2022 Barrett and Colter Poetry Awards ceremony. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and let's give our winners one more round of applause.
Wrapping up today's edition of the WHFR Journal, we presented the Barrett Creative Writing Contest Award winners in a ceremony that was presented here on the Henry Ford College campus last week, April 21st, at about 12:30, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. From all of us here at WHFR and Henry Ford College, we congratulate all the winners and all those who applied to be a part of the contest for their work, and we're glad to share it with you here on the WHFR Journal. Even if the audio wasn't perfect at some points of it, we appreciate the college for providing the footage for us to bring to you today here on the WHFR Journal. Stay tuned. Kitty Love is up next for a trip down Highway 61. Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn on 89.3, online at WHFR.FM. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dennis Brown II of Plymouth, Michigan. April is Autism Awareness Month. Did you know that 1 in 44 kids in the United States was diagnosed with autism in 2021? That was from the Centers for Disease Control. It breaks down as 1 in 27 for boys and 1 in 116 for girls. For more information, log on to autismspeaks.org.
Take your favorite non-commercial radio station with you wherever you go with the WHFR radio app, now available for free in the Google Play Store. After installing the app, you can listen to WHFR live to your Android device anywhere in the world. There are also articles posted by WHFR staff and the latest updates to the WHFR schedule. WHFR to go, free delivery, now available on the WHFR app and the Google Play Store.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists.
Stay.